Good evening. My name is Elena Maria Viramontes, and I'm the director of the Creative Writing Program. thank you. An appreciative crowd, that's what we want. Please turn off your cell phones right now. Take 60 seconds to turn off your cell phones, because this is going to be a remarkable event. As part of the Centennial Plus 5 celebration of creative writing at Cornell, this reading and rhythm event is made possible through the generosity of two anonymous alumni, and we thank them for their belief, faith, and love in the written word. In the beginning, we grew curious of the rhythm of our own hearts, and since, until now, we've had the impulse to express and record these strong beatings through the lyrical and rhythmic languages of prayers, blessings, and sacred conjures. From the indigenous oral chants to the written scriptures, from the Quran to the Bible, we have always tried to explore the significance of music in our constant conversation with what is we call existence. We do so by the imbrication of disciplines. Thus, writing and music in cohort, in collaboration, or as muse, brings on a renewed dimension of understanding, an acoustic sense beyond print. But more so, the presence of a musical instrument allows for writers to become performers within their own narratives. And this is what the rhythm and reading event is all about. First, to share with us this writing, his writing and musical talents, is J. Robert Lennon, assistant professor of creative writing at Cornell, who, I assure you, is a Renaissance man. Greatly enthused by a challenge, Lennon has written 6 novels, a short story collection, countless book reviews, short craft essays, flash fictions, maintains a blog with fiction writer Rian Alice, and is the father of 2 sons. He has been published in the Paris Review, Granta, Harper's, Playboy, and The New Yorker. With remarkable creative energy, his photography brings out the hidden life of things and people stilled by their surroundings in his current exhibition titled Words in the Wild. This one in collaboration with Ed Skoog. Not to mention that John's alter ego, Inverse Room, has a new album that has just been released and is available there on the table. You may also be familiar with John's voice at Writers at Cornell blog, where you can listen to his interviews with our visiting writers. A generous teacher, award-winning writer, wonderful colleague, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. J. Robert Lennon.
This is kind of unnerving. I had imagined you all shrouded in darkness. And I would just get to pretend that I was alone here, but that's not going to happen now. I have 3 things to present to you tonight in the 20 or so minutes that I have the floor. 2 of them are songs, and 1 of them is a short story, and they are all on the theme of tragedy in the workplace. And I don't know what it says about me that I have multiple songs on this topic, but, and this isn't even all of them, but I'll start with a song, then I'll do a story, then I'll do a song.
I spilled my martini on the photocopier. Don't mind me, I'm just drinking on job. I threw up all over the break room refrigerator. Please don't mind me, I'm drinking on the job. I hope that you will be discreet. I go AWOL from the corporate retreat. I try to requisition a case of Johnny Walker so I could keep drinking on the job. Holidays, 10-minute breaks, lunch hours, vacations just make me long to wake up in the men's room with an Excedrin headache. All the damage in my wake, the endless miles of red tape, and I am not ashamed to say I do it all for your sake, for your sake. I found myself resting beneath the conference table after a day of drinking on the job. The janitor says that he won't get me in trouble. He's no stranger to drinking on the job. The star employees line the hall. I find your picture and I steal it off the wall. I hope that you'll join me in the supply closet. Together we'll drink on the job. Together we'll drink on the job.
I'm going to move this mic because, for the moment, my privates have nothing to say. Later, though, I'm sure they'll start talking. The album that Elena mentioned is called Exquisite Replica by my alter ego, Inverse Room, and to indicate that it's a full band arrangements, there's little iterations of me holding different instruments on the cover. And that song is on it, if you want to hear that. It's over there on the table. $10. And if you think of physical media as passé, as obsolete, you can also buy a download from inverseroom.com, my website, of course. So my undergraduate Reading for Writers course, every week the students respond to an experimental writing prompt. And a few weeks ago, one of the ones they could choose was, excuse me, because this is going to require some major hydration. The one that some of them chose was to take a utilitarian form of text that is not usually used for art and write a short story based on that text. And one student wrote a story based on the instructions on a bottle of medicine. Someone did one based on a lab report, and they were really funny, and we had a great time with them. And so after a class, when we discussed them, I walked back to my office, and by the time I got to my office, I had this story. So I just wrote this for this reading. It's called Tour. Hi, everybody. Welcome to beautiful Onteo, New York, and to Seven Lakes University. My name is Isabel Schumann. I'm a junior here at SLU, and I'll be your tour guide today. We've got some beautiful fall weather this morning, and there's a lot of ground to cover, so we'd better get started. As we walk about the campus, please feel free to ask me any questions you might have about academics, campus life, history, whatever. Okay? Okay. First, let me tell you about this statue some of you guys are leaning against. No, that's all right. Leaning's allowed. Rest those legs while you still can. The statue is of SLU's founder, Edwin Stanton, Revolutionary War hero, businessman, and landscape painter. Stanton was born in 1758 and started our fair university in 1828 when he was 70 years old.
Kind of old to start a college, don't you think? Anyway, that's him there. According to campus tradition, if you kiss him at midnight on Valentine's Day, you'll fall in love. Maybe with one of the EMTs who come to unstick your lips? Haha, just kidding. Let's move on. Here on your left is Bain Library. When midterms come along, students like to say it's the bane of their existence. People here are funny that way. What's that? The workload? Yes, SLU is known for its rigorous academic standards. The library is open all night, so you can spend every waking hour preparing for the glorious future your dad keeps telling you you're going to have. Well, some people's dads, anyway. Maybe you dads are more laid back. You look pretty relaxed to me, sir. Of course, I should warn you that if you're a junior, like me, and still haven't declared a major, there's not much point to being in Bain in the middle of the night. All those books, all that knowledge, I mean, if you don't already have direction in your life, you know, all it does is make you feel stupid. You might sit there at some grad student's carol in the dark, perfectly still, waiting for some kind of inspiration to strike, and then wake up in the morning face down on the desk over a little puddle of drool. But I'm sure that won't be a problem for any of you. Oh yes, majors. Most students with their heads on straight, as my dad would say, generally declare a major by their sophomore year. You'll do that right over there, on your right, in Mullen Hall, the administration building. Mullen was the third building built on this campus in 1839, when SLU was just a distant outpost on a hill. It was just renovated last year, thanks to the generosity of some MBA graduate or another, who now has a hallway named after him. Imagine walking down a hallway with the same name as you. Isabel Schumann Hallway. Can you picture that? My hallway would be really long, long and dark, with no end in sight, and no doors on either side, haha. Mullen is also where you can receive a sternly worded warning from a career counselor if you want, or if your dad wants, and where you could even spray paint a phallus on the career counselor's office window if you're good at climbing trees. No, ma'am, I'm just kidding. Tree climbing is prohibited here after a fraternity prank that turned tragic in 1989. As we cross the Arts Quad, look to your left. You'll see that we have a beautiful view of Onteo Lake, deepest of the Seven Lakes region. Legend has it that there's a cave down there, an underwater cave. And the cave leads to an underground river that flows all the way to the Mississippi. Sometimes a student goes missing, and I like to think that they were taken by the lake, you know, as a kind of offering. Wouldn't that be something, to be taken by Onteo Lake, you know, sacrificed to appease the gods or something? What's that, sir? Oh, no, I'm only joking about the sacrifices and all. No, not many students go missing. One or two a year, maybe. Most of them are probably just drunk or something. Speaking of social-like life, look over here on your right. It's Greek Row. That's where all the fraternities and sororities are. Rush week is in spring semester, right before midterms, so if you're a girl, you know, block out some time to make yourself presentable. Lose some weight, paint your face, buy some slutty shoes. If you're a guy, don't worry about it, just slap on some cologne and practice calling people bro. If your dad insists that you rush, my advice is don't, and then tell him you did. But that's just me. If he tells you he wants you to have some friends, for Christ's sake, tell him you have lots of friends. And when he asks you to name one, just make something up. But make sure it's a name you can remember later. Don't be creative. Don't call her Wilhelmina or Ruperta or Jocko, because eventually he'll catch you in the lie. And before you know it, you'll be dangling from a tree with a can of spray paint in your hand. No, ma'am, still kidding. Over here on the left, and by the way, did you notice how good I am at that? Because I'm walking backwards, and it's actually my right, but I can say left without hardly thinking, because I have your best interests in mind. That's what Mom used to tell me, put yourself in others' shoes. Always think about how other people feel. Put other people first. I really took that to heart. Other people, they're important. You're all very important to me today. I want you to know that. Anyway, on the left, there is the student union, Wiggins Hall, which we all call Wiggler, as in, see you in Wiggler. If you go out on a date, a lot of the time, the guy will say, meet you in Wiggler at 8, and you'll actually, it's embarrassing to even say it, you'll actually go out and buy a dress from the vintage clothing store down in the village of Onteo and take it in yourself, because sewing is the only thing you're any good at, and you haven't been eating much lately. And you'll stand right over there by those big wooden doors with the leaded windows for 10, 15, 30 minutes, an hour, just smoking cigarettes, and then grinding them out on the cement with your sneaker, and you just won't want to admit you got stood up. But hey, no big deal, right? If you just stand there all evening smoking and swearing, like, quietly to yourself. Sir, that's kind of you to say. My mother used to say it, too. Izzy, you're such a pretty girl. Thank you. Over here on the right, your right, of course, not mine, my right isn't important, is Kane Hall, home of the English department. The tenure committee is taking out their notebooks right now. I know you parents don't like the idea, but there are a lot of English majors here at SLU, and you can see some of them right over there with their horn-rimmed glasses and ripped jeans and messy hair talking about books. You can also take creative writing classes, like, for instance, the Personal Essay Workshop, where you pour out your heart and soul in one long, unbroken sentence about your mother's breast cancer, and then sit in silence while everybody tells you it's self-indulgent and incoherent and ungrammatical. And then, afterward, the professor asks you to come up to his office, and he closes the door and apologizes and asks if you're all right. And in a moment of weakness, you burst into tears, and you tell him how you really feel, and he puts his arm around you and says, "There, there," and before you know it, he's kissing you, and your shirt's half off, and he's telling you how you're both adults, and how it's good for professors and students to have this kind of close relationship. And then, you're having sex with him right there against the bookcase. And maybe you wonder, shouldn't this feel good? Shouldn't this be exciting? You've never had sex before because you were afraid you wouldn't like it. And here you are, not liking it. And not for the first time, you wonder if maybe something is wrong with you. And after that, you expect your professor will watch your back in class, but he doesn't. Quite the contrary. He really goes to town on your next essay, and later he says it's because he doesn't want the other students to suspect what's been going on. But really, you see the look in his eyes. He criticizes you. It's just like the one he gets when he's taking your jeans off and telling you you're too skinny. And you realize he is a bad guy, and you wonder why you didn't know this right off the bat. And it's because you're always thinking of others, just like your mother told you to. You can't think of yourself at all. You just feel like a fool when you do. And you can't tell left from right anymore, and you spend half your waking hours walking backwards, never seeing what's coming. And you keep saying the same things over and over. By the way, don't go thinking all the English professors are like that. I'm sure there are some super nice ones. Actually, no, good question. No, this is not the usual tour. This one's different. Actually, ma'am, step aside for that bicyclist, please. Thank you. I wasn't going to tell you all this, but this is my last campus tour. Seriously, I'm never doing it again. They asked me to stop, and anyway, my work-study money is about to be cut off because of my grades. All C's, except for a D in the essay class because the professor didn't want anyone to suspect. Admissions doesn't like me because I keep straying from the script. Like just now, I was supposed to tell you about sports at SLU, like about how great the soccer team is. I know I should. Some of you kids look like you'd probably be good at soccer. But can you do me a favor and just kind of imagine how awesome SLU soccer must be? Just imagine yourselves looking all Euro in your shorts and kicking a point or shooting a goal or whatever and the crowd going wild, because I have some major stuff to cover here. So where was I? Oh, right. We're approaching the life sciences quad now. This is all new. There used to be a little hiking trail there where a girl got raped once. Oh, don't worry. You won't get raped. It was just a one-time thing. And anyway, the trail is gone now. I used to go back there and walk and smoke. I even camped out in those woods one night with my quilt and a little pile of paperbacks. That's my best memory of SLU, waking up with my books all dewy and the sun coming down through the leaves, and then that vet student helping me back to my dorm. Now, though, that ground is home to the Vernon Russell Center for Bioethics. They have these symposiums in there, you know, a bunch of smart guys sitting around a table deciding whether it's right to make mice glow or corn talk or whatever. If you look up there, ooh, whoops, sorry, didn't see you there, are you okay? If you look up there at that window, the one with the balcony, that's where they sit and have their debates. You can even try and get into one if you want. Like, for instance, you could stand here on the sidewalk shouting up at the arguing scientists, telling them about how your mom didn't say anything about the lump in her breast because she was afraid your dad would divorce her if she had to get a mastectomy. So she just kind of hoped it would go away, and by the time she went to the doctor, it was too late. You could stand here and ask them, real loud, what are the ethics there? Is it your mom's fault for being so weak or for being stupid enough to marry your dad? Or is it your dad's fault for being such a prick? Or is it your fault somehow? Like, maybe once you realized how hopeless your parents were, you should have done something about it, like got your mom to leave him, get a checkup, have a life. Maybe while you're out here screaming at the Vernon Russell Center for Bioethics, and the scientists are looking down at you and waiting for campus security to show up, maybe then you could decide that, all things considered, it's easiest to blame your own stupid self. That's super nice of you, ma'am. I really appreciate that. I know that rationally, it's not my fault. But sometimes, you know, everything's so complicated, it's just easier to blame stuff on yourself. Like the Iraq War, or swine flu, or hurricane season, or whatever. I mean, there's people out there who think God makes hurricanes to punish gays, right? It's just as likely that it's my fault. That's all I'm saying. Sorry, New Orleans. That reminds me, after the English professor thing, I thought maybe I was gay, so I tried it out. But as it happens, I didn't much like that either. Yes, I know, you guys are getting tired. You're growing kids. You're probably hungry. Don't worry, the tour's almost over. You'll be done by lunchtime, I promise. Here, we'll skip the entomology lab and the dairy research center. I myself personally am lactose intolerant. I can't even stand getting near that place. Maybe that's what my problem was with my mother. I didn't breastfeed, you know, I had to have soy formula. Up until they figured that out, I was crying all night long. And sometimes even today, I wake up in the middle of the night or the middle of the afternoon, whenever I happen to be sleeping, with this excruciating, like, ghost stomach ache. Oh, God, it's agony, and it takes half an hour to go away. It's like a dream you can't shake. Enough about that, though. Cross the street here with me. Hey, man, pedestrians in the crosswalk, hold your horses. Jesus, some people. And here we are on Harrison Walk. This wide brick pathway used to be a train track. Back in Edwin Stanton's day, the train would dump coal directly into hoppers in the basements of Main Hall and Stanton Hall, right over there, and would be used to power the furnaces. This is called the Humanities Triangle. History and Anthro and some other stuff are here. And if you ever get a class in Stanton 105, you should make sure you sit in the very back, because you can look out the window, past the corner of the health center, and across the street into the Fine Arts Building, where there's usually some pasty-looking person with no clothes on, posing for a drawing class. There's nothing titillating about it. In fact, it's kind of sad to see them there, frozen in some unnatural position, looking so vulnerable and unhealthy. But maybe one of you could pose for a drawing class someday. You're all healthy-looking young men and women. You could do it, right? Or are you too embarrassed about your bodies? You shouldn't be. You really shouldn't. You look just like all the other people. You know, the same parts and such. Everyone at college should be naked all the time, so we would all be embarrassed, not just some of us. Congress should be naked, too. Anytime anybody argues, they should be naked. Oh, God, I got carried away. I totally didn't see that bush. Thank you, ma'am, for trying to warn me. I thought you were just having a little seizure there. No, I'm all right. In fact, we're at the last stop on the campus tour, Ivy Tower, home of the famous SLU chimes. Now, can anyone tell me why it's called Ivy Tower? That is a good guess, but no. You'd think so, wouldn't you, being as it's covered with ivy? No, the ivy came later. It was actually named after a woman named Ivy Coburn, the wife of a man named Jonas Coburn, who was a member of the very first graduating class here at SLU, and later donated the money for the tower and chimes. He did it all for her. He loved her so much. And when the tower was finished, that would have been 1870, as you can see there on the cornerstone, and the chimes were installed, there was to be a big dedication ceremony, and Mrs. Coburn was supposed to be there, and they were going to play Old Folks at Home, which was her favorite song. But sadly, she died only days before the dedication. Isn't that sad? Isn't it sad, but just so totally beautiful? Jonas Coburn was devastated. In fact, he killed himself in a library with a pistol. No, not Bain Library. Though wouldn't that be something? It would be haunted today, I'm sure. But no, the library in his house on Lakeshore Avenue down in the village. I have a surprise for all of you. You see, for a little while, I used to play the chimes. When I first came to SLU, I signed up to be a chimes player, a carillonist. And I trained, and I actually played the noon songs every Thursday for most of a semester. By the way, sir, do you have a watch? Yes? Thank you. We still have time. Anyway, I used to play the chimes. But certain elements here did not like my choice of music, and I was forced out of the job. Thank you for asking. Ma'am, I favored the piano music of Anton Webern and Alban Berg. You haven't heard Discordance, ma'am, until you've heard it on those bells. It's enough to make you poop in your pants. Pardon me, that's a little bit disgusting, but that's what it feels like. I guess people walking to class or playing frisbee on the quad didn't like it. At any rate, here's the thing. They kicked me off the lineup, but they forgot to delete me from the database. So look, my ID still opens the door. Generally, visitors are not allowed in the tower, but I'm making a special exception for all of you. Come on. Yes, I agree, sir. It is quite strenuous climbing all these stairs. How many? I actually know the answer. There are 217. I counted them myself many times on my way up to play the chimes. It's easier if you just think of someone you hate being down on the ground. And with every step you take, you're getting a little farther away, a little bit more beyond their grasp. Like, for instance, if your father has told you that if you don't get your grades up, he isn't going to pay your tuition anymore, and in fact, he's going to bring you back to your hometown and have you institutionalized up on what, in high school, you and your friends used to call Looney Hill. If you can imagine that, you'll see how good it feels to climb higher and higher away from him, higher than his office building, higher than the hospital on Looney Hill. Up so high, it's like you're in heaven with your mother, if in fact there was a heaven, and your mother got in. Which reminds me, you kids, if you want an insider tip for getting into SLU, you might want to write about this experience in your admission essay, the experience you're having right now of climbing the stairs to the top of the tower, this unusual campus tour, and the weird girl who gave it. Not everyone gets to have such an experience. Pay close attention. Take notes. Aha, I see that some of you really do have notebooks. Good, very good. You're going to fit right in here. Well, we're almost there. I know you're out of breath, but wow, wait until you see the view. Look there on your left, through the glass. It's my old friend Warren, my ex-friend Warren, getting ready to play the chimes. Maybe we're still friends, I don't know. Anyway, I've used up the last scrap of friend cred I had with him to convince him to do me a favor, play Old Folks at Home for me, today at noon in honor of Ivy Coburn. You know the tune I mean, right? Way down upon the Suwannee River, far, far away. It was a big deal in the 1850s. Not hearing it on the radio, there was no radio yet, but playing it on the piano. You'd get sheet music, you know, the very latest sheet music, and Old Folks at Home was a smash hit. Hi, Warren, are you gonna play it? See, we are still friends. He's holding up three fingers, that means 3 minutes. 3 minutes until noon. Let's go up another 19 stairs. We're almost to the top. And finally, here we are. Go ahead, look out at the big, beautiful world below. Careful, don't lean out too far. Doesn't it look like it wants to eat you? That world, the lake, the hills, the houses and streets and people. It's a monster, a big, gentle monster that wants nothing more than to swallow you up. Here, I'm having trouble seeing you all. Would you help me up onto the rail? Don't worry, I'll be all right. Yes, sir, just give me a little boost. I'm not very heavy anymore. There, thank you. I'm glad I can see you all now. It was hard trying to peer through the crowd at everyone's face. No, ma'am, I'm perfectly comfortable, thank you. I'll just grip this stone here. It feels good. I'm perfectly balanced. So this is the end of your introduction to SLU, and the end of my final tour. No, please, don't applaud. I should be applauding for you, and I would if I didn't need to keep my hand on the wall. You have been so awesome. You really have. I just know you kids are all going to be admitted this winter, and a year from now, you'll all be down there below, walking and laughing with your friends, and maybe, just maybe remembering this very day when you first saw your new home. As for me, I probably shouldn't have come to school here, but maybe it would have been the same wherever I went. I don't think SLU was my problem, or even my parents. It's all up here in my head, all right in here. Yes, sir, I know about those medications, and I've taken some of them, and they do make things easier. Thank you for the suggestion. But it seemed to me that all they were really doing was packing everything deeper and deeper into my head. They didn't sweep anything away or blow anything up. It was just pushing more and more stuff in there, more and more stuff, more than my mind could hold. I mean, look at me. I'm just a little thing, just a sack of skin and bones. I couldn't hold all that. I can't. I'm sorry, I really am. The time, sir? Thank you. Well, any second now, Warren is going to start the song, and I'm going to say goodbye. I hope this has been an interesting day for you. I know it has been for me. Good luck. Good luck applying to SLU. Good luck with everything. Please don't follow me from this point. You should turn around and walk back down the stairs. The chimes will be playing Old Folks at Home, so feel free to sing along, or at least hum if you don't know the words. And when you exit below, please turn to the right. Don't look left. Don't look for me. Just walk out the door and turn to the right, your right, and go get some lunch at Wiggler. Just turn right and walk frontwards down the hill, away from this tour, away from the chimes, toward the rest of your lives. And whatever you do, don't look back. Don't look back. Trust me, there will be nothing here, nothing at all to see. This song is not on the album, but if you go to inverseroom.com or jrobertlennon.com, it's a free e-single. I-single? E-single? You could put on your e-pod, your iPod. By the way, if you have, it's good that you turn your phones off, but if you have the app with the lighter on it, and you want to go like that, that's... No. Anyway, thank you for listening to me, I hope, I'm really looking forward to seeing everyone else tonight, Lyra and Johnny and Richie and Ermon. So thanks.
It was late, I was dead. You were crying on my grave. I was looking up your dress. I was filled with happiness at the things that you said that I never heard in life. That the lawyers told you not to say until they took the house away. I was on top of the world, 6 feet under the ground, and I found stranger than they said. I was reaching for the saw when the scaffolding collapsed, and in a minute. mental lapse. My life forgot to pass before my eyes. I was on top of the world, 6 feet under the ground. Can never walk away, but I will never walk away. It was late, I was dead, and my life forgot to pass before my eyes.
Thanks.
Full disclosure, I am H.G. Carrillo's number one fan. Not in the crazy ways of hero worship, but in my constant marveling of his stories, in my admiration for the mural canvas of his language, and for a fully realized acoustic imagined world. Assistant professor in creative writing at George Washington University, Carrillo has garnered great respect as a writer for the nurtured contextualization, sensuality that permeates his work. Paul Lisicki, yes, you know who he is, writes of Carrillo's, quote, structurally adventuresome sentences that compel the reader to slow down, to inhabit their music. He evokes the senses, his regard for the body and time. He pays attention to place, to weather, the appalling condition of our own weather. He's not afraid to be political. He keeps on speaking into that awe-inspiring space between people, whether they're here or whether they're gone on, in the hopes that someone out there will be willing to close the gap, mind to mind, unquote. For this, Carrillo has been awarded with the Glimmer Train First Prize Fiction Award, 2 First Prize Fiction Awards in the Author Lynn Andrews Fiction Competition. Twice his stories were shortlisted for the O. Henry Award, and in 2004 he received the Iowa Award in Fiction. I am delighted that he is taking a break from his second novel to join us, and I am extremely pleased to call him a friend. Ladies and gentlemen, G.H. Carrillo.
Seven Octobers, I lived in Ithaca, New York, and it was never 63 degrees once. I'll do my thing over here, and I'll do my thing over there.
Thank you.
Well, the hard part's over. I'm going to read from the new novel. Am I actually showing up here? Okay. I'm going to read from the new novel. And actually, here's a warning to anyone here out there writing a novel right now. Don't get terribly attached to titles. It's interesting, too, because actually there's a part of this that takes place in Ithaca that I'm going to read. But for years, I've been very attached to the title Twilight of the Small Havanas. And I was just at a reading, I just gave a reading at Rutgers, and Jane Ann Phillips says, "It sounds so vampirous." It's not. I'm sorry. Yeah. My privates won't be doing anything either. This is just the opening of the book, so I don't think that I need to explain it too much. La Banalquena. Sí, 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 claro. She's in Little Havana. Has somehow gotten herself to Calle Ocho with all its light and noise during probably what has to be the 100th, no, at least the 1,000th time that she can remember that it's been announced that the dictator is dead. Officially dead this time, baby. Someone alongside her is yelling in her ear. Dead like Fred, dead like dead, 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 mamita. And it's been a while since she's last seen the boy. An hour or so since he disappeared. CCC disappeared into a moist fold of late afternoon, early evening light. When a drunk, ever so drunk, yelling, "You're the puta, you're the motherfucking puta," is shoved out of La Casa Panza by two men dressed as waiters. He careens the sidewalk, his expensive suit rumpled, tie askew. His wiry gray hair flies, though it's that he's lost a cufflink, the open sleeve flooding around what looks like a snipped marionette's sweet farewell that she notices as he stumbles, nearly mows her down before falling face first onto the curb. And yet, holding her breath, it's not the man twisting on the ground in front of her that thrusts her heart in her throat, but that she has no idea how she got there, or why her own name won't float to the surface of the jumble that seems to be her head. A parade of cars passing, tops down, windows open, jams, shouts, and bleats of horns into the air. Y la música, sí, sí, of course. Music pours out of every restaurant, souvenir shop, and bodega. A different tune, bolero, mambo. From every open window, trumpets wail. Hands, fingers, over thumbs, tumble hundreds of conga skins. And after that, trying to get to his feet, the drunk coils, hips over belly, and opens his wide, bloody smile up at her. Él está muerto, you hear? He spits, muerto. The somewhere a bitch está muerto, he slurs. We can all go home now, todos, we can all go, he yells. But as fast as it comes out of him, the roar around them sucks it up. Muerto, 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 they all yell, muerto, like dead or something like that. Sprays of confetti-made razor blades menace the air. And finalmente, someone wails as though she's discovered something. They're all going home after all these years. Finalmente, finalmente, another repeats as if trying to fashion a lyric around it. As if both languages weren't failing them, falling over each other. As if, in Spanish, there was a precise word, one exact phrase, for what came so easily for them in English when they got there. They could go to their houses, their homeland, she thinks, to their fatherland, their mother country, but in the street, all around her, it is home that they yell. Home as if they knew where they were going. And it's home, home, home that threatens to the surface of her eardrums. It begins to aspirate the H, open the E to an A. And suddenly, ome, ome is misheard across the street and becomes ole, ole. They're yelling, vying in the convergence of the congas. So many voices, so much yelling, noise, and artificial light. Fluorescent, neon pinks, greens, and blues that no one seems to hear, which she's certain are 6 gunshots fired in a row. Quick and deep as an itch, deep as heartbreak, something tells her they are neither accident nor celebration. Her knees collapse, sending her into a crouch, where she is certain there is one person, someone, who can speak for everyone around them, calling out dead with the same timing of a measured, trained, even-hand shooter. Dead, 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 like combined wishes of everyone milling around her to see the dictator's lifeless body rise up from the ground as he had hundreds, no, at least thousands of times before, and come after one of them, only to be shut down again, dead. There's a low growl in the center of her head and at the base of her skull, and she takes it to be a good sign, knowing it will grow into a shriek, eventually push its way out, a sign, a signal of whatever she took at whatever party. See, it must have been a party. She and the boy were always going to the party pills. She checks the crook of her arm for fresh needle marks. Maybe she snorted something. Whatever it is beginning to ease off without letting up completely. She looks around, wants to, needs to find her own reflection as much as she's fearful of what she'll see. Not ready for the Medusa-like black curls that she suspects rise off the top of her head as they fall on her neck, bare shoulders, and back. She's certain her makeup is a bleed of a raccoon's mask. One by one, rather than the names of the shops and the restaurants, it's the shapes of the buildings she identifies and suddenly knows what they do rather than what they are. Where to buy fruit, where it used to be easy to steal a handful of candy without anyone paying too much attention. There used to be a man with a bright, toothless smile who pushed a cart up the street selling jorapo. And if you were wearing a school uniform skirt, if you could pretend not to notice that his fly was open at the same time you noticed his fly was open, your second cup was free. Around the corner, on this second floor, above a bodega, there used to be a place where you could be absolved of all your transgressions, throw your hate into someone else's lap, and go home with a shaker of hope. Sambas and mambo, the beating of drums slap her face, congas on top of congas, hey-hee, cry a rude rustle of skirts as it throws its head back and swings its hips to the beat, making its way into the parade. The drunk cranes his neck and follows to repeat the sound and repeats the sound, and it's just that, the two of them screeching at each other, that makes her head want to split. As if to hold onto something herself, she spells Phenacrobus rudder. And there it is. She knows what they are, birds in front of her, pink birds, long legs, long wingspans, pink strong. The birds around Pinar del Ríos. The tendrils along the wingspans of pink, hard-kneed, Phenacrobus rudder. But their common name won't come to her. Olé, olé, they yell across the street and around her. And there, the sudden clatter of bracelets in front of her, a rush of long, tangled black hair with a screech of necklaces and jangling cleavage that is almost like watching some part of herself pass by. And suddenly, Melisunga Helene comes easily. Hundreds of them, tiny little ones, blue and orange and gray flutterings, zunzuncitos at first, and then hummingbirds comes to her. Sio, sio, they screech. And as she mouths the word, she recognizes them, can identify their genus, their order. She remembers writing something about their cries, being imperceptible to the human ear. But having heard it, she knows she heard it. Hundreds of them, thousands of them fly towards her. Zio, zio. They screech, forcing their way past her lips, exploding out the back of her head. And along with their droppings, they leave the question about their ails, questions about fungi growing underneath their wings, that seems to cause them to be consumed in mid-flight. Sio, sio, they screech. Breathe, she says, and she tastes the grit of dust and feathers on her tongue and the roof of her mouth. Breathe, she says, as she exhales something, the taste in her mouth, the taste of their nitrates, of white bird droppings in her nostrils, something makes her say, mala noche. It doesn't make sense to her. Mala, she says, bad noche. She says, night, bad night, bad night, very bad night. Sio, sio, the birds cry. Aye, the drunk yells again. But the rustle of skirts is too far away to distinguish it from any of the other noises on the street. He calls again, hard as though he's about to turn himself inside out. And in he comes. And it comes back at her all at once, all of a sudden, sudden awareness, something, the awareness of drowning. This time it was home. Mala, mala noche, quizás, 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 a place she'd been raised to call home. Ome, ome, ole, oye, they yell around the street at her. Nirkamegui, she remembers her mother telling her, but don't let them stamp their passport, she said. Sio, sio, she yells. Mala, mala noche, and suddenly she remembers having been arrested. Don't let them stamp their passport, they said. She remembers having gotten put in jail. Mala, 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 mala noche. Though the exact number, the exact date, the number she wrote across her chest, the number she wore across her chest, the exact numbers, clean and measured, exact, it occurs to her that's what she does. She does science. Aye, the drunk screams, and hand over fist, the congas tumble. Ome, 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 they yell. She's headed home. She told her family. She told her friends. She told her friends in the lab where she was working at the time. Don't let them stamp your passport, they said. Sio, sio, si, si, si. She had worked in a lab at one time. Can see herself in some working part of her past in which she's bent over a microscope. White lab coat, but she cannot recall what she sees. She remembers driving to Toronto, leaving her car in the lot. It's only for a month or so she didn't tell, she told people, they said, don't let them stamp your passport. Everyone she knew in the lab, on campus, had said it. It was the best way to go. Everyone she knew up north, CCC, that's it. She'd been at graduate school somewhere up north, somewhere where it snowed. And no one she knew down in Miami had ever got caught. Don't let them stamp your passport. Boarding a plane to Canada, landing in Jose Marti Airport. Don't let them stamp your passport, they said. Take a lot of cash, they told her. They believed in the kind of work she was doing. They believed what she said. They believed they were going. So many had done it before. It was an easy trip. They were grateful. It was easy. It was an easy in, easy out. Don't let them stamp your passport. Aye, the drunk screams. Home, they had yelled around her. Home, seal, seal, the hummingbirds, birds, hummingbirds, susuncitos. She had been working on a fungus that was attacking hummingbirds. Seal. Birds, they were her birds. Birds, susuncitos. It hadn't been a bad night. Malanoche, she had been to Malanoche. You said it to Malanoche. Malanoche de Cuba. Cuba, a place her mother, her father had taught her entire life to call home. Sio, sio. Home, they chanted. Ome, ome. Seemed to set off line after line of firecrackers in the distance. A sound it makes now that she knows is not gunshots, but they were gunshots before. Sio, sio. The birds were her birds. Susuncitos. Susuncitos. The street was home, but not home. Don't let them stab your passport. Sio, sio. And somehow she belonged to the street. She belonged to this home. She belonged to the boy. She belonged to the gun. But the boy, they were quicksilver years. 8, 10 maybe. She didn't know with the boy. Years ragged as lightning jags, comprised of 101 I dare yous. A wiry boy, hair quick. He dared her to leave her bag in the bushes, dared her to put her tongue in his nostrils, dared her to sniff the white powder off the tip of his fingers. And she had found, in exchange, she dared him to let her stick her fingers up his ass. She dared him to seduce a man out of his tie. She had dared him to steal an entire bottle of rum at the Algonquin while the bartender's back was turned in response to his dare. To smell his fingers if he had been with a woman who had given him $50 extra on a Central Park cab ride together. She'd gotten out of jail when she, Sio Sio, had first seen him. Ratty t-shirt with the same old mobile corporation logo, Pegasus, breaking up and fading. Paint slattered, worn chonclos, work boots, no socks, begging chains. He'd been near Gramercy Park. Hombre, por favor, can I have a few? I need a few. I need to get my hands on some anal beads and a Billy Idol poster. No mames. Por favor, mamita, porfa, I'm so hungry and thirsty. Coño, I gotta tell you, you got some fine legs on you. Pardoneme, ma'am, pardoneme, my name is Pablo, and I've been in the way from my own country for a long time. Pardoneme, ma'am, my name is Juan, and you remind me of a very kind woman I left back home so far away. Pardoneme, compadre, pardoneme, sir, pardoneme, senor, pardoneme, chico, you know what it's like to come over. Oigame ese, escúchame, cabrón, señorita, 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 señora, I ain't gonna lie to you, I need to get high before I kill someone, no shit. And sitting at a distance on the park bench, she'd watched him for 2 or 3 hours, more hours. She was still on the kind of time the judge had mandated. She had let them stamp her passport, where suddenly, much less than calendars were important. She had nowhere to go, no one to think of, and she had just begun to walk. Walk, she tells herself now. Walk and breathe. Aye, the drunk wails. But nothing comes back. Ole, ole, the trumpets blare from across the street. Fresh out of jail. Ome, ome, they tell her across the street. Out of jail for going home. Her father had paid the fine, the court costs, the new clothes that were on her back. Sio, sio. He and her mother, they would help her forget about everything that happened before. As if nothing had gone wrong, as if she had done nothing wrong. It wasn't her fault. And she remembers he wouldn't hang up until she lied. She lied. She'd go directly to American Express. She'd get directly on the plane. She'd use the cast. But she had no idea. She had no idea whatsoever that the boy in the Pegasus shirt would dare her to kiss him, would turn and dare her to steal a book of poems from the Barnes & Noble on 22nd Street. She had dared him to fuck her on the subway during rush hour, and he had often dared her that while they were eating in the cafeteria to show her tits to the counterman so they could eat all they could hold and run. Sio, sio, it had been a fine summer, a beautiful summer. It had been a summer of unspooling itself as a series of opportunities rather than days. They slept in the park. They stood with their hands out when they wanted to. But there was nothing to want for. The sky was always blue, and she thought that she had nothing to do. There was nothing going to happen, and suddenly there were towers falling behind them. Aye, the drunk screams as he remembers, too. The boy had dared her to fall in love with him, and she took her hand as the dust fell. Ole, ole, they chanted, and he began to feel the movement in her lower body. Began to think, she thinks she can feel the movement. She can feel it. She can feel it coming. Breathe, she says, Sio, sio. Oh, may, breathe, sio, sio. But like that, it cuts her, razoring edge. It's a razoring edge of a hawk's wing. Sio, she has it. Oh, may, they yell. Sio, aye, the drunk rings. Sio, sio, sio. She has it in midair. Sio, she pulls it from midair. Sio, it's there. Her name is Xiomara. Coño. The drunk hisses. Gracias.
Adage, Larrey Van Cleef Stefanon needs little introduction. That is, other than asking you to join me in a big applause, because Larrey's second collection of poetry, Open Interval, has been nominated for the National Book Award. Woo! In Bomb magazine earlier this year, Susie DeFord asked Larrey, "Your poem all reads like a blues song. Have you ever set any of your poems to music? Any of your poems to music? How does music play into your writing?" And Larrey replied, "Each year here in Ithaca, there is a festival called Light in Winter, celebrating the cross-pollination between science and the arts. Last year, I did a reading accompanied by Johnny Dowell at their festival and sang Moll. With Moll, I wanted to try to write a blues poem and tap into that sense of woe and play. Music has come to play a more important role in my writing life since I moved to Ithaca. The first night I heard Johnny Dowell, I knew I wanted to do something collaborative with him, particularly given my new obsession, the in-betweenness, the distance. Musicians fascinate me. I wanted to ask him, how far is it from here to there, creatively? I really wanted to know about his process. I sent him a copy of Black Swan. We did a gig together at a local record shop, and people responded well to it, so we did it again. I've since done other gigs with the amazing banjo player, Richie Stearns. The banjo is my new obsession and is in some ways inspiring my new manuscript, The Coal Tar Colors. And there's a renewed interest in the instrument's African roots and in the African-American string bangs, for which I am glad. Now, Lord, Lyrae continues, Lord willing, and if the creek don't rise, the three of us are supposed to perform at an event for Cornell's Creative Writing Program reading series in October. Well, Lyrae, the creek didn't rise, and the time has come now, and it is my pleasure to present Johnny Dowell, Richie Stearns, and Lyrae Van Cleef Stefanon.
Thank you all so much for coming out this evening. This is just too much fun for me because I just really love to hear these two guys do everything that they do. So it's just kind of, I'm getting to play with an audience. I'm getting to have some fun.
Keep laughing. Oh,
okay. So, these are two of my favorite musicians, Richie Stearns and Johnny Dowell. They're also very funny, but usually I can't repeat the things that they say, so. I cannot. No, Johnny tried to be a hero the other night and it got him into trouble. I'll just say that. Johnny got beat up by a girl on the common. Johnny was watching a fight or saw a fight happening and thought it was two guys fighting and then realized that it was a guy beating up a girl. And so got in there like he was gonna put a stop to this. And as soon as he pulled them apart, then the girl started smacking him upside the head. We all wish that there had been a camera there for the look on his face when he was getting beaten up. It's neat, I'm gonna be reading a bunch of Dear John poems from Open Interval, and it's always fun for me to read the Dear John poems with Johnny Dowell because the poems make me think of him. But then now, John Lennon read tonight too. So there's another John to add to your list of Johns. I know, John, that's why I wrote about the name. There's so much space in the name, right? There's everything in that name, John. There's too much in it. Dear John, a woman writes a letter. One need read no further. Your name, the site to which she won't return. I heard Mark used for mock when I was young. Old men sang quit, marking me like birds. Swan, eagle, vulture, the summer triangle. This was the South. This is the North. And I am, and I was, astronomical parlance. Lyrae, I took to textbooks. I will leave here too, but I digress. Take you, for example. Dear John, winking demon, you are 18 in November 1782, watching the sky as ever, master of a perfect silence. The first night, you note the change and understand. You belong to her. And you will lie stock still on the rooftop December to May to learn her. You do not know the sound of your own name, the shape of hers in your mouth. You are patient for what she will teach each evening. She gives you so little, it seems almost less. Tensed for the sensation you fear, this must be hearing. She turns your whole body to an ear. Each morning you wake stiff with listening. Dear John, invention. There, in Groningen, the body, you wait for me to give you. And your mother, as I imagine her, dealing with your fever, her faith. The university, a heaven of sorts, beyond you, glittering. Out the window, the voice you release, crying. Here, Mick Jagger sings Wild Horses. There, Banneker carves his wooden clock, writes his note to Jefferson. There, there, Levina croons, soothing you silent. The difference between sound and silence, this lying distance. Blues for Dame Van Winkle. I drove over to the Catskills, met a woman there like me. Took a trip down to the Catskills, was a girl there just like me. Not so much waiting for her man as she was waiting to feel free. Neem. I know a child who believes he passed through a black hole when he was born. Talking with him, I wonder if he somehow remembers his actual birth. What was it like? I ask him. It doesn't really matter to me whether imagination or experience makes his memory. Once, in Africa, I got so stoned, I time traveled. I walked into a kitchen to find I'd entered my mother's life. It hung about me like a cloud, her apartment kitchen in the city, the 60s, visible, almost tangible. The memory still grips me, leads me by my wrist. The reefer doesn't make me believe it any less. How does memory work? Attached to some mnemonic, it's irresistible. A planet drifts off the list, but for my very educated mother, I cannot forget it. Dear Pluto, I walk this town in search of you. Think I might discover you still in my neighborhood behind the PNC. But no, that's Neptune in the little park. Blue blip held embolic in the thick glass of its concrete obelisk. When my mother warned the city would get into my blood if I didn't quit returning to it, was she remembering that kitchen I visited apparitional? I smoked myself into her Manhattan. Had she described it as someplace I would love, as my father's element, as replete with poets? I remember. She called them a bunch of Afroed black folk gathered in a basement chanting, "I am angry." How did it get into her blood? It is there on the move in Florida, on laundry days. My 13th birthday, I wear the ruby birthstone ring she bought me from Sears as we hang sheets. I hate the smell the backyard air will give them. She hates everything, yet insists this ritual. She is angry. I wish she'd leave the laundry to me, leave me to the itching humidity and crushed grass, the green plastic basket she shoves along beneath the line. Her anger always took her back to days of wringer washer, scrub board. She rubbed her knuckles raw against my life, left me the glint of three hard jewels, red for love, for July, summer, cancer, ruby, red hard knots of blood. She died of an embolism, a word that also means prayer and nonsense, whose root means an intercalation of days to correct errors. The ways we pad the calendar year so our year syncs with the solar year. Here in Ithaca, the solar system's laid out on the streets at 1/5 billionth scale. Each day, a new transparency overlaying the last, as though at last it were possible to slip corrections between. Summer's air stifling, thick with the weight of what can't be seen. So many thin, clear plastic sheets, suffocating. And I think of that child called John, a name so common as to also mean anonymous, his name an event horizon. How the letters must hold some speck of memory, some trace of every previous John imparted to him. How can he help but feel their ever flattening pull?
Richie Stearns and Johnny Dab.